Hello there, welcome to Life Matters. Yes, Natasha Mitchell joining you this morning on ABC RN. Feeling lighter somehow. It must be that missing appendix. Yes, that little evolutionary throwback. It decided it wanted out last weekend. It seems from all the stories I've had since from people, mine hung in there a whole lot longer than most. And thank you to Cassie McCullough for taking the reins at very short notice last week. And here's cheers to my fellow ward mates at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. Really lovely women. May the three of you recover fast. And a belated International Women's Day to you all, because I didn't get to say that. In fact, coming up on the show, Israeli and Palestinian women sharing a conversation, a theatrical conversation, about one of the most intractable and distressing conflicts of our time. That's in our Crossroads series. And also, if we all have to stay in the paid workforce until we're 70, go on, tell us how. You're talking about it on our Facebook page. You can tweet us too, at RN Life Matters. Now, family violence, it is now considered a national epidemic. It's not just the sheer number of assaults that's concerning. They're getting more brutal, it seems, too. Since January, 15 women have died as a result of family violence, three of them in just the past week. And as we heard on RN Breakfast earlier, Liberal and Labor State Attorneys General have sent a strong letter to their federal colleague George Brandis expressing their opposition to the $40 million in cuts slated for the legal aid sector over the next 4 years. Here's part of what they say. These proposals will affect the most vulnerable members in our community, including foremost women and children who are victims of or at risk of family violence, as well as Indigenous Australians. It's difficult to reconcile these actions with the Prime Minister's recent recognition of the importance of tackling domestic and family violence and closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. We're going to head to a part of Australia where these cuts will be felt very acutely in just a moment to meet a lawyer at a legal service. But Background Briefing's Hagar Cohen travelled to Broken Hill in far west New South Wales. And a warning, you may find some of the descriptions and language in this report from her rather disturbing.
It's a sunny morning in Broken Hill and the town centre is still sleepy. But just off the main drag, a community centre for women is already bustling. All of the women who came here for support have survived shocking abuse at home.
The first time I was 6 or 7 months pregnant with my second child, we were laying in bed and he pushed me out of bed onto the floor and told me to fuck off and whatnot. It shocked me because up until that sort of point, everything had been going along pretty good, and then all of a sudden it was, get the fuck away from me. I married him about 3 months later.
Alison survived 18 years of psychological abuse.
He was always told how dumb and fat and stupid and always degraded to the lowest form. Makes you feel like shit. Makes you feel worthless.
2 days after she decided to leave him, Alison's husband turned up with a knife.
He had a 20-centimetre butcher's knife standing at the front door, telling me I wasn't allowed to leave and I wasn't doing this and I wasn't doing that, and until my daughter come home. When my daughter come home, she seen him standing in the door with the knife and everything, and that seemed to mellow him long enough to go away from me and let me leave.
Stories like Alison's are painfully common. Detective Inspector Mick Stoltenberg says the rate of domestic violence in Broken Hill is so high, the damage it creates exacerbates other areas of crime.
It plays a significant role. It would, you know, a perfect example, if we're looking at a spate of break and enters that are going on, generally what we find is the people who we are identifying, arresting and convicting before the court for doing those break and enters are people who come from DV homes. They may already be in a DV relationship themselves. It does play a significant role in the things that I have to consider on a day-to-day basis.
Mick Stoltenberg has seen some horrific domestic violence injuries.
He flogged her for an hour and killed her, and her entire chest and every organ was like jello.
Just last month, he attended the sentencing of a local man who murdered his partner.
The male
And Fumar went home early hours of the morning, and she was subjected to one of the most savage beatings, which killed her. Significant damages to her face, chest, all her organs. He was just sentenced to 21 years for that straight out, cold-blooded, extremely violent, DV-related murder. And
women who endure severe physical attacks like this one will often end up in the local hospital.
We've seen facial fractures, we've seen skull fractures. I mean, from a point of view of mortality risk, being battered and beaten around the head can be pretty serious.
Director of the Broken Hill Hospital Emergency Department, Dr. Andrew Olesnicki.
I think regardless of the physical injuries that the victims come in with, there can be massive psychological undertones that happen to these victims. So they can be fairly minor on first glance injuries, but someone who's actually extremely dysfunctional or disabled by that victimisation. And that's something that's a lot harder to nut out. You know, you can't do a CAT scan and measure someone's degree of psychological damage as a result of years of sort of domestic violence and domestic abuse. And look, I'd like to think that in a lot of cases, bones and skin and muscle tissue will heal, but it can be a lot harder to fix those other things.
Most domestic violence victims won't end up in hospital, however. They're more likely to ring police or a support worker or even a refuge. But it's hard to know who to turn to and who can provide good practical advice. Lawyer Mariette Cocorito says many of her clients were turned away by police officers because the women couldn't produce concrete evidence of an assault.
I often deal with police in situations where women tell me they have been given incredibly incorrect information by police that, oh, we can't do anything because the perpetrator's not present, or we can't take your word for it, or it's your word against his, we can't prove it. And, you know, in those circumstances, I feel really upset for the victim, because it takes so much for a person to reach out to say, I need help. Often that phone call to police is their very first and most desperate cry for assistance. What I can say is that the women who come to our service, we don't take that for an answer.
Women who apply for an AVO without the support of police have to argue their case in court on their own. There are two court advocacy workers who are there to comfort the women. Narelle Blows and Loretta Stewart say the women who aren't represented by police are sometimes required to cross-examine the perpetrator in court.
They just don't want to go through the system, you know, because they have to represent themselves, so.
And have you had women pulling out of the court, of an AVO application because of that?
Yeah, that happens regularly.
Regularly?
Yep. I think a lot of them will go through the beginning, and then they'll just, if they have to represent themselves, they're just not, they just won't show, and then the application will usually get dismissed. It's just hard for them. Like, they're already been through enough and feel, they're intimidated and they're scared, and just the fact that they have to get up there and stand up in front of the other person is just too hard for them.
Fortunately, Mariette Cocorito's legal centre provides free legal services for those women who need it, but not for long. In 4 months, just like many other community legal centres around Australia, most of their funding will be gone.
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. I really don't. I am dreadful at saying no, and it absolutely guts me to have to say to people, I can't help you.
She mentions Georgia, a woman who recently came for help when she escaped the deadly force of her drug-addicted husband.
She was in a situation that was very volatile. By volatile, I'm really talking about physical danger. She was in imminent physical danger.
And then he's, walked over to me while I'm feeding the child, the baby, and grabbed me by the throat, stood me up out of my chair and cut my windpipe off to the point where I couldn't breathe. And my eyes started to glass over, and that's when he let me go. Of course, I didn't think it was right, but I loved him. I loved him a lot.
This is Georgia. She recently left her tormentor for good. But she says it was her lawyer, Mariette, who gave her the strength to stay away from the violence.
I didn't even know that I could get away from him. I I just thought I was stuck there for life, basically.
It's not just legal services being cut. Last year, the New South Wales state government cut funding to refuges across the state. The Broken Hill Refuge was forced to reduce staff by 60% and go from being open 24/7 to business hours only.
Do you reckon you could show me around? Or is that...
Yeah, no, we can go for a bit of a...
On top of that, the Salvos who run this refuge have also implemented a strict payments regime that will help with cutting their costs. The women at the refuge are charged for their stay, and those who don't pay aren't allowed in. Lieutenant Philip Sutcliffe is their new manager.
So because of that, people are finding that it's not just simply a service that they can come and use and abuse. We've got, you know, clients on our list that have racked up hundreds of dollars of debt from our service. So, you know,
so they can't come back unless they pay off their debts.
Yeah. So we run that program because as part of our case management, we want to help them get into sustainable accommodation. And it's, as I said before, it's not just a use and abuse type service.
Have you actually had to turn some women away because of debt?
Not recently, but yeah.
It happened in the past.
Yeah, it has happened in the past.
So if they're in real dangerous situations.
Yeah, you know, every circumstance is different and it's, you know, completely up to the discretion. You know, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that, you know, where possible, those debts are getting cleared.
A previous case worker at the refuge, Fiona Camilleri, says women were always charged for their stay. But those who couldn't make the payments would have their debts wiped. Fiona resigned last year.
I didn't believe in my job anymore. Does it all just come down to money? And that was a rude shock for me. Too bad about people's lives, about children's lives, that these women suffering, escaping from a domestic violent relationship. Sorry, it doesn't work that way.
Yes, Fiona Camilleri there. She's a former caseworker at a Salvation Army run refuge in Broken Hill. And that report from Background Briefing's Hagar Cohen. And you can hear a fuller feature from Hagar on the Background Briefing website. We wanted to head back to Broken Hill now, though, to hear what the slated cuts to legal aid around Australia will mean for one service there in Broken Hill. Tracy Willow joins us. She's CEO of the Far West Community Legal Service in Broken Hill. Good morning to you, Tracy.
Hi, Natasha.
Let's just start with this question and then we'll get to your funding story. Why are domestic violence rates more than twice the New South Wales average in and around Broken Hill, where you work?
Oh, that's a really complex question.
It's a damn complex question, isn't it?
I just took a deep breath because I've just finished listening to the program and many of our workers that day in, day out fight for women and children in our community. We're a long way away from capital cities, a long way away from Dubbo. The culture in Broken Hill is tough and hard. We have a lack of services. We work really well together, or we try to work really well together, but all these things together just present really big issues and sometimes with really scary results.
What sorts of scary results?
Well, you know, whilst we know that there are 15 women across Australia that have died so far, and Mick Stoltenberg talked about one in the north of the state, for most women it's just trying to survive terrifying environments, which are called the family home. And the difficulty is that whilst some women are black and blue and broken with bones and bruises, so many women are just terrorised, verbally stalked. I mean, these are not stories that we hear occasionally. These are stories we hear every day of the week.
And it's a lonely road in a dense urban environment in the heart of a capital city. It's a possibly an even lonelier road if you're living in an isolated community.
Well, absolutely, because where do you go? You know, we've got we're 3 hours from Mildura, five hours from Adelaide, and 13 from Sydney.
So how wide is your reach as a service, as a community legal service there? Based in Broken Hill, who are your clients? How far does your reach?
The Far West, which is about a third of the state of New South Wales.
A third of the state.
Yet we're based in Broken Hill, and I have three lawyers, two administration workers and myself, and our role is to cover the state.
When you say cover the state, what sorts of services are you providing families?
Well, day to day in Broken Hill, we provide advice, court representation, advocacy, support, referral, but we can only get to Wilcannia and Menindee once a fortnight, and to the outer areas, we can only get to them on a quarterly basis. We try to provide, you know, a phone service, but for lots of people, that's not a simple option. We can try to make Skype available, but that's definitely, for most people, not an option. So people sometimes have to come in on buses, or if they can make it into town and it's safe, then they'll come and find us in the town square. That's kind of what it's like.
You are both a lawyer and a social worker, you've got that joint perspective, I guess, in terms of the needs of your clients.
Sorry, Natasha, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a social worker and a manager.
Okay, I've got that clearer now. Thanks.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Your funding story is quite complex, isn't it? And it's an example of what a rollercoaster ride this sector has been experiencing. And in fact, you successfully, I gather, lobbied for more money under the former Federal Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus. Tell us your funding story.
Well, about a year or so before that was when I arrived, and we as a team knew that we just couldn't keep operating the way we were. We were drowning as a service, you know. We don't just cover Broken Hill. We cover, as I said, the far west of New South Wales. So we lobbied in every way possible, including having, you know, garage stalls and market stalls, and we even took pay cuts, the senior workers. We did everything we could, and of course then we got enhanced funding through the previous federal government. That day was like winning the lottery.
How much money?
Well, we initially got $215,000 extra, and then for the next 3 years after that would be $190,000. So we were able for 2 years to just reap the benefits, so that we are doing the most amazing, effective work. We're getting out into our community. We were able to hire three lawyers, which is just so important. We've been able to be really active in trying to work with our community in terms of community education, but also programs which are about building safer and stronger communities. And then we got the announcement that as of 1 July this year, for the next 2 years, $190,000 this year and next year will be removed. And that's only the beginning of the cuts. And for us, that was like the biggest, most devastating punch, because what it says is that we can't keep operating the way we are. In fact, we'll hardly operate at all.
Well, what will it mean? That, because this is additional funding. So you were operating before you got that additional money.
On the smell of an oily rag, yes.
What sort of an oily rag?
Well, we were receiving roughly just over $200,000. And that was
In total?
And then for any other little bits and pieces we got, we added to that. Because we also don't just operate a community legal centre. We manage now three other services. So our role is to provide governance and to strengthen those other services so they can operate really effectively.
Because you also have under your auspices the Aboriginal Family Violence Service, mm-hmm. I gather, as well. Mm-hmm. So what will the loss of funding mean for you, but most particularly for the women that you're supporting in and around Broken Hill? And when we say in and around Broken Hill, well, a wide geographic mm-hmm. reach, as you've described.
Well, my position will go because there's not the funding for that. We will we're more than likely only to have one solicitor. If we're lucky, we can stretch it to 1.5, but the principal solicitor will have to become the operational manager as well, because we still have these other services we need to oversee. Our administration will be slashed. So in an effect, we will go from being a service open 5.5 days a week to essentially 2 days a week. We won't be doing the outreach we are now doing. We won't be doing community legal education to the scale that we are.
What does it mean for women?
Well, like Georgia, who spoke on your program, she got an immediate service. The next woman who comes to us may not get that. What's important about this is that we provide frontline services, and for those who are in the most urgent need, they get it immediately. That will stop.
The Prime Minister has publicly stated a commitment to responding to domestic violence. He wants this to be the most urgent issue for the COAG agenda this year. He has made that very clear publicly. So what would you like to put to him?
Well, if he was listening, I would say, I think that is absolutely a fantastic commitment. But can I say, words alone won't make the difference, particularly for women in rural and remote communities. If we don't have funding to operate, if we can't do the job that we're supposed to be doing, then women will die. And nobody wants to know that. Nobody wants that as part of their story. Because the effect isn't only for the victim. It's for their families and for communities in rural and remote communities. Death and serious injury impacts enormously.
Tracy Willow, thank you very much for making the time this morning, and we'll follow your case with interest. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Tracy Willow is CEO of Far West Community Legal Service in Broken Hill, a wide geographic reach, as we've heard. And you can hear more of Hagar Cohen's background briefing report, which really covered the rural and regional impact of cuts to domestic violence services very closely. And we'll pop a link on the Life Matters website, or just head straight to the background briefing website. The audio is there. And we'd like to hear from you. If you are affected directly by cuts to domestic violence services or legal aid services, please get on our website and email us, or you can comment on our website as well, or tweet us at RN Life Matters. Our listener feedback line 0283 1430. Right, well, a cracking conversation going on our Facebook page about how we stay in the game in the paid workforce until we're 70. How are you feeling about that? Coming up. From where I'm sitting, it's going to be a long time before I get to retire. Last week's intergenerational report reinforces that message, which with its social and economic predictions for Australia over the next four decades. The message from the Federal Treasurer is we're living longer, so we'll need to work longer to maintain our standard of living. But of course, it's easier said than done. And even when we want to work on, and despite government campaigns against ageism in the workplace and cash bonuses for employers who hire workers over 50, employers continue to favour young recruits. If we're all going to stay in the work game until we're 70 or beyond, what will it take? Kay Fellick has some ideas. She's publisher of Your Life Choices, Australia's largest retirement website, and she joins us on the line. Kay, thanks.
Good morning, Natasha.
Welcome. I mean, by its nature, the intergenerational report, trying to look 40 years into the future, is at best an educated guess. But to maintain Australia's economic prosperity, do you share the report's view that more people, more of us, will need to work until we're 70 or even beyond?
Well, Natasha, I think the report's really interesting in that a document from Treasury, a worthy document, should spark a debate. So I love that, because, you know, we need to look further out than the three-year electoral cycle. This particular report appears to have had a chapter inserted which is perhaps slightly more political. Put that aside, raising the question of work is really important, but work itself is not a stable scenario. The rules of the game have changed enormously.
Mm. And many people on our Facebook page, Kay, are saying, all very well, but where are the jobs and the employers who would facilitate it? Most people over 50 find it hard to get a job, says Stella. So what is going to change in order for a 70-year-old to find work?
Well, this is where I think the national conversation is extremely important, and an intergenerational report calls that on. We know unemployment right now is 6.4% officially. Underemployment is much higher, and this is where I'm sure many of your listeners are thinking, well, I'm called retired, I'd love to do paid work, how do I get myself going? And I'm not clear that paying employers a $10,000 bonus is where I'd be putting the money.
Where would you be putting the money? And I wonder whether this report, in naming this issue, might encourage employers to shift their thinking, knowing this is a national imperative in place to keep us at work longer.
Well, as a strong believer in the goodness of human nature, I'm sure we would all like to do more and do a better job of keeping people employed. The cynic in me says it's like the Second World War when women were put in factories to work. The boys came home, the women had to then get out and go and love their white goods because they weren't needed in the factories. That is cynical, I'm sorry. So
nothing wrong with
go.
A bit of healthy cynicism, Kay.
Skepticism, whatever we wish to call it. So here we go. We need older workers, but back in the 70s, they were the first to get the exit papers when we had massive unemployment and so on. How can we get better at this? I would urge those people in their 40s right now to think of their work as a lifelong journey, and today to be demanding the training that often people in their 40s and 50s are overlooked for. And I think we have to be our own best advocates in terms of staying skilled up in order to go forward. So we can't just be good at one thing anymore. That would be comforting, and that would be, you know, make us feel good. Oh, I'm a great nurse or a hairdresser. But they're two careers in particular where our bodies can give out.
Mm. See, now this is really crucial, isn't it? This idea of prepare, given this national conversation about staying in the workforce until we're 70, this idea that we should be preparing in our late 30s and early 40s for this eventuality, that is crucial, isn't it? So training is one suggestion you're making, that we self-advocate to keep our skills vibrant and transforming and up to date. Up to date is tricky, isn't it? Because you don't really know where your skill set's going to be, need to sort of shift.
No.
What other?
You can only be as good as you can be good with the knowledge you have today. But I think also we have spurts of activity around our careers. So maybe at age 18 or 21 and mum and dad rush you off to a career counsellor, and there's a lot of conversation. What do you like? What are your passions and so on? And then we kind of let it all go, don't we? We get busy, maybe we're raising children or building a business or something, and somehow we let that keeping our passions, our hobbies, our interests alive, we let go.
And people sort of settle into their set of expertise get comfortable. So the shock of a redundancy in your 50s is profound.
It's a terrible thing, and that's when your confidence takes a massive hit. Because I used to be a pick a career, a piano tuner, and I am no longer that, so what am I? Mm. So this is where I think the networking skill is really important, not in the crude way of handing out business cards, but in keeping in touch with people in your industry and related industries, going to the conference. You know, if your employer won't pay for you to go to the conference and it's semi-affordable, why don't you go anyway?
Take the leave and go.
Why don't you meet someone who knows someone who knows something? And similarly, Natasha, I think the old-fashioned idea of contacting companies directly and saying, this is what I do, can I chat about it? I'm not asking for a job. I'm just coming in to have a chat about what you do and what I do and see if there's any crossover points. That can actually reward you in new contexts as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. This is really useful, I think. But it's also up to employers to actively target those 40-something-year-old workers.
I think employers certainly could do a better job. I'm really keen in terms of this discussion to recognise the value of younger workers who are doing it tough, and to think about What can older workers in their workplace do to help younger workers take on skills, which builds a mentoring role for older workers, which employers could well facilitate?
Yes, that's a great idea. Yeah,
you can see the connection points, but where's the policy? This is where my $10,000 would be going.
Yes, to building mentoring relationships and programs, then everyone has a vital role in the workplace. Being self-employed online businesses, is that a do you consider that a real alternative for us as we age as workers, creating our own jobs rather than trying to beat our head against a workforce that wants to go for younger workers?
Look, I think building our own jobs is noble and terrific. As someone who's involved in running a website, it's not as easy as it looks from the outside. And you do have to build something over a long period of time, and that does take investment. So I think sometimes we can jump into, oh, well, I can't do that, so therefore I'll just start my own business. You actually need a plan, a business plan. You need financial support. You need to be good at managing. So not to be negative, but if you've got that great idea, you really need to touch base with management, with sales and financial expertise.
Just thinking about the debates over pension, where the age pension will head, where superannuation policy will head, you're critical, Kay, of tax breaks given to superannuation. But the argument can be made. If a government wants more self-funded retirees and less reliance on the pension in the next 40 years... many will ask, why shouldn't we help that help with a tax break for superannuation contributions? Is this not a good policy?
Look, my problem is that we beat up on people who are living 40% below the poverty line, right? People who are on a pension do not live the life of Riley. And I think the discourse has been around that. I think, yes, we need breaks for superannuation, but not for the super, super, super rich. There is, given the amount of money going into tax breaks for superannuation, it will overtake the cost of the age pension shortly. So the self-funded retiree is not self-funded. They're funded by a government tax break. And I actually think we should call it for what it is.
With the concern of the pension burden, as is often the term used, and you've probably got something to say about that too. I mean, given the combination of longer working lives and mandatory superannuation contributions, but might the age pension become less important in the next 40 years if we think about the conclusions of the intergenerational report?
Well, look, the trajectory is and always was that self-funded would take over from the pension. The fact that the SGC, the super contributions, were stalled for something like 8 years under the previous Conservative government is an opportunity lost. So yes, we do need higher and higher contributions, so compulsory contributions. And then, yes, there would be less dependence on the pension. I think that the issue is, Natasha, there are so many levers here that could be finely tuned instead of having this either or conversation. I mean, currently we have legislation sitting before the Senate to further reduce the age pension, knowing that many people on it are living in poverty. Why would we be doing that when we could more finely tune the super concessions and come up with a happier outcome for most ordinary Australians?
Why would we be doing that? I'd like to hear from Life Matters listeners about that. Kay, thank you very much for joining us. Working on until 70, how are we going to do it? I really, really take a lot from your point about preparing ourselves in our 30s and 40s for a long working life. That will really shift cultures, I think, if we have that conversation more actively. Thanks for joining us this morning.
That's a pleasure, Natasha.
Kay Falick was our guest, publisher of Your Life Choices. It's a retirement website, details of that on the Life Matters website. And thank you for your thoughts on our Facebook page. Peter's written, in no uncertain terms. He says retiring at 70 is okay for office workers and other shiny asses, but no good for people who do physical labour. Most old workers in the physical labours are buggered by the time they are in their late 50s. Their problems are mostly arthritic from worn out joints, and in many cases their health is ruined by toxic workplaces having ingested poisons over their work years. It's well known that engine mechanics, marine engineers and chemical workers have shorter lives than the general population. Retirement should be left at 65, he says, so the elderly can enjoy a break before they die. Also, retirement allows space to open up for the young to move into the workforce. So a whole range of views on our Facebook page on this one, working until we're 70. But I'm also interested in your thoughts about this idea of really planning for a long working life in our 40s, like getting on board with training. We might look at that a bit further, training opportunities in mid-career and what sorts of opportunities you've taken and sought out. Natasha Mitchell with you for Life Matters this morning here on ABC RN. Great to have your company. Tweet us at RN Life Matters. The next in our wonderful Crossroads series coming up, Abe's Babes. Who are they? Over the last few Mondays, we've explored intimate and unexpected stories in our Crossroads series. Humour, comedy, pets, family reunions, the stories of refugee communities told through the voices of Australia's Arab and North African communities. Well, today you'll meet two groups of women finding ways of bridging deep divides, perhaps differences, conflict. This is really something. You'll hear about Abe's Babes and also the Olive Tree Women's Network, but Nadiet can explain more. Here she is with Crossroads.
Hello and welcome to Crossroads, a series exploring change, turning points and choices in Arabic-speaking and North African communities. I'm Nadia Tilgouli here on RN. What happens when you have an idea you think should work? Well, you get your friends and networks to help you. That's what Fatima Karouche and Yvonne Perchuk did. A few years ago, they started something that's connecting women in profound ways. Fatima began a network called the Olive Tree Women's Network, or OWN, which not only links together a diversity of women, but also helps to build trust between communities, which to Fatima starts with women. Yvonne Perchuk also had an idea that homed in on the roots of a problem. From a German Jewish background, she wanted to do something that brought Jews and Muslims together to tackle the thorny issue of prejudice and the politics of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Together with other Jewish, Christian and Muslim women, she formed Abe's Babes, a group combining the three Abrahamic faiths in a play which in many ways is about listening.
Israel makes any possible effort not to hit civilians. And what is going on, that Hamas targets...
Children were killed in their sleep, the UN said. This is an affront to all of us, a source of universal shame.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says no amount of international pressure will stop Israel acting against what he calls terrorists.
We believe about 70 people have been injured. We've seen women, we've seen children, and we've seen elderly men. At the moment, the precise figure isn't known. The debate will begin immediately about who is responsible for this.
If everybody individual thinks like, oh, I'm on just one person, then what can I do about that? I always like to think of the fact that if you throw a single pebble into a pond, the wave it creates will reach the shore, you know, and we're hoping to be that pebble.
He came up to me later and I said to him, why did you cry? And he said, because I really never heard the other side the way I heard it today, and it's changed me.
Oh my God, we need to speak Arabic quickly!
They don't speak Arabic. Oh my God, this baby is dead.
Can you please tell the mother her baby is dead?
I'm not, I said, such a tiny boy.
So many tiny boys.
Who to save?
Who to save? I mean, where do I start?
An excerpt from The Laden Table, a play exploring the politics of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and prejudice. Before that, one of the co-facilitators, Yvonne Pachuk. She and Noor Alam, along with Abe's Babes, worked together for several years on a theatre production exploring prejudice within Australian communities. And the play uses the metaphor of the dinner table to scrutinise these ideas. It wasn't easy, and the group had to let some people go at various times. Yvonne Pachuk.
We had a few painful situations as well as this being a great labour of love and a long journey. People who joined our group enthusiastically at the beginning felt as if they had to pull out because they didn't feel comfortable. In a couple of cases, it was their families didn't feel comfortable about them being part of this sort of process. And we had to let these people go, as sad as we were, because they were so enthusiastic to be part of this at the beginning. And then we had the other side of the coin, where we had people who joined again enthusiastically, but had a very strong political agenda. And we had to explain to them that we understood that the politics are a really sensitive issue. What we were really wanting to address is the way the Israel-Palestine problem, how that feeds into the prejudice at the table. And what we're interested in is looking at the prejudice at the table here in Sydney, here and now. And that was our focus. I guess I feel really strongly about this because my parents are Holocaust survivors and they were victims of just this kind of prejudice, and that's where it starts. It starts at the dinner table. It starts with families infecting each of the generations with this kind of prejudice, and so that's where we really wanted to focus and to challenge that kind of prejudice.
What we are trying to do is like holding up a mirror. The play actually deals not just with Holocaust or the religious prejudices and things. It actually deals with what is happening with young people trying to fit into society, the middle generation dealing with things that are from the old country and the new country. There are also the issues of older people dealing with isolation as an older person. So this play allows you to deal with multiple issues in a short space of time.
Tell me about the characters you have in the play. Describe some of them.
There are several generations at each table. We have some older people, ones who would actually have been through either the Holocaust or the Nakba. We have a generation that is the middle generation that can sometimes see both sides. One, yes, they have a responsibility for their parents and all the burden that comes with that. And they also have their children. The third level is the young people who are, I suppose, a little bit removed from the actual act of the Holocaust or the Nakba. But they are still involved in it because they are either going back to support organizations or to find themselves, but they're also trying to deal with living as migrants' children.
Writer, poet and co-facilitator of the Abe's Babes project, Noor Alam. Early last year, Abe's Babes teamed up with Bakehouse Theatre, an independent theatre group with a focus on presenting culturally diverse voices and telling stories they believe are missing from the Australian stage. With Bakehouse Theatre on board, the play went to a stage reading in July last year, at a time of an escalating conflict in Gaza. I spoke to Suzanne Miller, Bakehouse's director, and asked her about staging a play like this at such a polarising time.
I would hope that a play like this allows that conversation to be much more within the context of compassion. That, yes, it's politics, but those politics are impacting in such an extraordinary way on the lives of not just one or two, but many. And I think the one thing this play does too is it connects what's happening in somewhere like Gaza with us here in Australia. It's not really that far away. There are families whose relatives are there. And I think when you have a wonderful cast like this, delivering lines with such clear and simple passion as complex characters that they've spent a number of weeks and a lot of rehearsals developing, I think that demands a greater attention and it demands a more compassionate response.
You're reliable for a Muslim and he hasn't even asked to be paid up front.
What do you mean for a Muslim?
I didn't mean anything. Maybe I shouldn't have said it quite that way. Sure, not all Muslims are bad.
Oh, even better, Dad.
But being quiet and listen for a minute, Ruthie. To be honest, they do have different values to us.
What are you talking about?
Prestige. Anyhow, Zadie's been fasting all day, haven't
you? Yeah, they've got the head out.
Abraham's a good man, but they're not all like that.
You're telling me.
We run, we lose everything. Everything. Now you, Ibrahim, you work with one. How can you do this, yes, Ibrahim?
But he's a good man. Look, let's not talk about this right now. It's going to upset
you. Yes, Smith, Ibrahim, sometimes you have to say what you think. We all know not all Jews are lying. Same thing.
I was a bit concerned because of all the controversy going on in the overseas at the moment. I have my views and the bombing is very sad, but prior to the bombing of Gaza, lots of rockets were flown into Israel and the world didn't notice that, which bothers me. But the thing is, I would like to see people be able to live side by side like they did a long way back.
A play like this doesn't give us any answers. It leaves us questioning what's going to happen in the future. So to ask those questions and to challenge us to question our own perspectives and our own perceptions of the other, that's what this is doing, and I think that's what all art should do, to challenge us.
Some audience members with their reactions to the performance. The organisers say they received an overwhelmingly positive response to The Laden Table, and Bakehouse Theatre will be taking it to full production at a mainstream theatre next year.
I'm now teaching my children that it's great to be a woman and we have a lot of strength. It's just that often we're brought up in an environment where we don't get the opportunity to experience that.
One lady went in the water and she said, I want to learn to surf, but I can't swim. And I'll never forget that. I thought, wow, this is absolutely fantastic. What courage.
The opportunity to go into different cultural groups and experiencing a day like they live, you know, that's so beautiful. And I think that should be done when you are in kindergarten, you know.
Every woman, doesn't matter what background you are, who doesn't want to be safe, who doesn't want to be respected? All our needs are exactly the same.
Fatima Karouche, the founder of the Olive Tree Women's Network, or OWN. Before her, Florencia, Nikki and Claire from a New South Wales Central Coast group which works closely with OWN. Fatima sees great value in mentoring young women who have ambitions but don't know how to realise them. And she was convinced a network of women beyond cultural group boundaries would help young, old and middle-aged women alike to reach their goals. The idea came from her experience as a migrant growing up in Australia, where she felt despite multiculturalism, people tended to stay within their own groups.
Well, I came to Australia in the early 1970s, and I think that was the birth of multiculturalism. But I felt as I was growing up into adulthood that I saw really more separation and that multicultural communities were excluded and whatever was provided for multicultural communities was more tokenistic and it was left up to each individual community to solve its own problems. Interculturalism, I see it as working smart. So rather than separating each community, let's see what strengths each community has and bring it together so we can all learn about each other. And it's not just about people that don't speak English, but we have Aboriginal communities, we have, you know, the white communities. Interculturalism makes us all one society, but at the same time, respect and appreciate the value of each community.
You're on IRN with me, Nadia Tilgawley, and Crossroads, a series exploring communities in change. The Olive Tree Women's Network has been going for 5 years. The group's work is focused on connecting women to each other and to educational, social, or employment opportunities. And they work through partnerships to run their activities. A significant one has been with WOW Girls, and WOW stands for Waves of Wisdom. I took a trip to the Central Coast to to meet the Wow Girls at a cafe on Avoca Beach. On the way there, the group's founder, Yvonne Lamont, who's been surfing since she was five, told me how she got started.
It started with surfing and the surfing Wow days, and we had 80 women turn up, and some of them were in their 60s and 70s saying, I've always wanted to do this. And then we realised that there was just so much more that women had missed out on. Because of the generation that I grew up in, women were expected to be at home and have the family and run the house and all those sorts of things. It wasn't encouraged for women, especially surfing, they were actually discouraged. So a lot of women did watch their boyfriends surfing and they sat on the beach and always wanted to do it. So this was their chance. And like I said, once we got together, we knew that there was just so much more than just surfing that women missed out on. And when Wow Girls started, we got such an interest from the local businesses providing the activities that we got into other Wow Day activities like singing and kayaking and belly dancing. And it's been very exciting and growing ever since.
At Avoca, I met Susan, Claire, Jenny, Florencia and Nikki at a beachside cafe. All the women spoke about how the group had changed their lives, from helping to overcome shyness, a lack of confidence and depression, to challenging their thinking on Muslims and Islam. Some had spent the Ramadan Iftar weekend in Lakemba. Jenny had already been on a camp with Own, which she says had opened her heart to Islam and cultural diversity. But the Iftar weekend gave her more to think about.
This was different. It was because we actually went to a community. We stayed in a Muslim home and we experienced more of the everyday life. We went to a mosque, we went to Lakemba during the month of Ramadan. It was just quite amazing because I don't think I've ever been down the street in Sydney or anywhere at 11 p.m. at night and seen so many people with families and with no alcohol. There was this vibrance, there was this amazing feeling. It was like a festival. And I just thought, man, we're just really missing out. Amazing.
Well, how do you tackle racism? And I suppose I'm interested in the moment that we're in now where there's a focus on the Muslim community and terrorism and where the rhetoric has been shrill from some media outlets. How would you now handle racist comments you might hear about Muslims or Lakemba?
I think what I would say to people is to not be so closed-minded, because unless you've been there and unless you have some understanding, it's really hard to make up your mind and to have these views. It's just not acceptable in this day and age to just have thoughts that are closed-minded and racist. Things are moving, things are changing, particularly the fact that Own and Fatima are reaching out to the community and they're wanting to connect, and I think that is a really important thing. I'd really like to see more Australian people be open-minded and realise that maybe you don't understand, maybe you don't know really what's going on.
The only way we're going to change this is doing things ourselves. I think it's through a simple thing of women bringing them together, breaking down these barriers and creating friendships amongst our community and just spreading that.
Yvonne Lamont from the Central Coast's Wow Girls. Ending that episode of Crossroads. It's produced by Nadiet El-Ghorli. Thank you, Nadiet. And we've got our last episode of the Crossroads series next week. I'll tell you more about that later in the week. Thank you too to sound engineer Lala Schooner and John Spence from ABC Archives. And details of Abe's Babes, the Wow Girls and the Olive Tree Women's Network up on the Life Matters webpage, where you can continue the conversation. Lots of you are talking about working on until you're 70. We are going to meet a 100-year-old dancer and choreographer. She's still at it on the show next. Coming up, the news. Bye from me.